You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. Slavery, for many people, the connotation of slavery, we all think back to prior to the Civil War, during the Civil War, and that certainly was problematic in this country. But slavery as an issue was much broader, perhaps still is, and the reasons for so go back many, many, many years in history. In fact, throughout parts of Europe, Africa, so many parts of this globe, where long before the United States, slavery became a big issue. And that's why I've invited my guest this week, author and journalist Jerry Lewis. Her new book is Slaves for Peanuts, A Story of Conquest, Liberation, and a Crop That Changed History. And we'll be talking for the next half hour with Jerry about the research that she's done and how an agricultural product actually was part of the groundwork for slavery as it relates to many parts, as I said, many parts of the globe. Jerry, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Al.
You know, you heard me at the outset. I talked about, okay, I mean, if you talk to most people in this country, they'll say, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, prior to the Civil War, slavery was you know, rampant. You know, African Americans were used strictly for cultivating cotton. And so that's where it all began. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, I don't think so. So even within the American context, I think slavery was both much more, like, had a broader application and was much more complicated than that. I always like to point out that that there were kind of gradations of slavery, like a range of enslaved experiences, even in America, where what we call it chattel slavery, where people were, you know, seen as objects essentially to be bought and sold, and that statute sort of extended to their children and their children's children, so it's a sort of in perpetuity enslavement. But that experience had some differences. Even in the United States, there were in some parts of the country there were some possibilities for people to buy themselves out of slavery eventually, or to integrate into the larger society. And so it was the same also in Africa. My book's mostly about West Africa, a particular part of West Africa, so I can't generalize about the whole continent, but you find there a range of experiences of enslavement. So some things that are closer to the American experience of, or the New World experience of chattel slavery, and some things that are much looser, that people were enslaved maybe in the first generation and then allowed to integrate into a kind of family structure.
Now, I said at the outset, and I use it only because I think I use it as an example because I think most people are familiar with the Civil War and you know, slavery and cotton here in this country. But you know, the title of your book is also, you know, the Slaves for Peanuts, the peanut crop, peanut oil, as you describe in your book, that was the product, the profitable product for slaveholders, right?
Yes. So it was the product of the peanut. Yes, it was the product in the book that is that I'm focusing on, that that forms the that it's like the target for the slave market, essentially, right? So that there's an increased demand for enslaved people because there's an increased demand for peanut oil in Europe. So the peanut oil is not necessarily in West Africa. So West African farmers are growing peanuts with enslaved labor, but for a European market, largely.
Was it very profitable, Jerry?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I was thinking about this the other day. It's hard to measure. I mean, it made it worth it to the large industries that were exploiting the trade. So I think it was a question of maybe, you know, certain cities especially where there was already a lot of trade with Africa, but who had developed large oil refining, I guess it is, practices,
mm-hmm.
and then and in areas where the where there was a big soap industry also.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it must have been very lucrative to them.
Yeah, I would think so. You read about, again, when you read American history, you read that not all, but many slave owners demanded, you know, hours of hard labor of their slaves, drove them hard, did not provide very well for them. Is there a parallel with, as you talked about, with that part of the continent in Africa versus here? I mean, were slave owners there any more liberal or any less violent with their slaves than here, or is it basically, you know, the same no matter where you go?
Well, like I mentioned just a little bit ago, I think that there was always a range, right? So that in the United States, there were plantation systems that were very hard and very extractive, and maybe there were plantation systems where, yeah, you worked really hard, but maybe you had a little bit of time off, not like time off, not like vacation, but maybe, you know,
yeah.
time in the evening to cultivate your own fields, and maybe there was less sort of physical punishment, right? But these things exist on a spectrum, and I think it's the same. It's the same in this part of the world. Also, I think that there are cases where people, enslaved people, say that they've been abused, that their life was very hard, that the master has beaten them. And then, of course, because the system of slavery is slightly different, there are cases where people work, they have more sort of well-defined periods of when they were laboring, like when they're working for the master and when they might be working for themselves and might be able to buy themselves out of slavery, like more quickly, and then integrate more in a way that's more accessible. And I think certainly that question of integrating the long term is significant in the African context, because we're not looking at a kind of racial system of enslavement. Everybody's black, right? So there's no question about, well, you know, how do you integrate after and how do you maintain those distinctions? There were distinctions, of course. There's this kind of question about kinship later that people can kind of look to, but it's not the same. The kind of racial valence isn't there.
Mm-hmm. And I want to pick up that word racial, because much of your work in the past is centered specifically. In fact, you've been an award-winning journalist who writes about agriculture and environment, which this relates to. But then there's that human, that social impact of the slavery. When you started the research for the book, were you intent on going that extra mile, so to speak, and bringing in the slavery issue, or did this evolve as you were doing your research on let's say the peanut industry and its effect on, you know, environment and agriculture, and then lo and behold find out that, you know, this was all part and parcel, or it became the only way it was able to run or function is because of slavery? So how did that all come about?
Well, I would say that they came about sort of together. My work, even though, yeah, I'm a journalist who focuses on the environment and agriculture, but I never sort of consider those things in isolation. The social and cultural context has always been very important to me, and I think that there's no, and maybe we shouldn't have we shouldn't be in the business of ever kind of considering environmental or agricultural issues without the social and cultural context.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this book kind of came about together. Like, I had been studying and thinking about the peanut growing regions of Senegal And considering how important it had been traditionally to the economy, but not just to the economy, that there are all kinds of social and cultural and religious factors that influence how peanuts were grown in Senegal and why, and the various kinds of camps of influence that dominated the peanut market, right? So the peanut's very complicated in Senegal in general. So I've been thinking about that, and then I sort of stumbled upon this question of slavery that I started to see in tandem with the question of peanuts. So I don't think I would have written this book if it were just about peanuts. You know what I mean?
Right.
To me, it was the additional slavery element that gave me the sort of impetus to write this book.
And rightfully so, because they, as you said, they do work in tandem, and it has made for a more interesting and more powerful topic, as you describe it in the book. I want to take a quick moment just to reintroduce my guest this week. She's an award-winning journalist and author, Jory Lewis. Her new book is Slaves for Peanuts, and we're talking about the in parts of Africa, long before most people are even familiar with. People think of slavery happening only here in this country, but the peanut trade, the agricultural product that was the foundation for slavery in parts of South Africa. And Jury brings to light, the people responsible for the peanut trade. And Jury, that's where I want to go next with this. In this country to this day, I mean, we know this. Here we are in the year 2022. Slavery and racial disharmony are still a topic that is raw in the lives of many, many people here in this country. You talk about the slave trade and peanut industry there in South Africa. Is it the same there as it is here? I mean, if you really wanted to get people to sit down in a focus group, would you find anger? Would you find emotions that run as high as you do in this country as it relates to slavery back then?
That's a good question. The legacy of slavery is very difficult to address here. It's not something most people want to talk about, and people who are descendants of the enslaved, that's probably not something they will bring up themselves, right? It's usually something said about them, and depending where you are, like whether you're in a more traditional context, like in a far-flung village or in the city that has like sort of varying degrees of impact on your life, right? So like the people in smaller villages where they're kind of locked into social roles might feel that legacy more keenly, whereas in the city where you have many opportunities to kind of reinvent yourself, that might not be an issue. But no, it's not a question that people talk about openly. No, not at all.
Okay. In this country, again, and I mentioned it early on, if you pick up a book about slavery in this country, especially early 19th century, you hear about big plantation owners being the dominant force behind that. But that part of South Africa and the region that you talk about, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking British Crown rule at the time.
This is of course West Africa, French speaking West
okay.
Africa. So, the book moves from a little bit from Sierra Leone, which is in fact under the British, right? And then a small colony called Gambia, which is still English speaking. But the rest of the book is really mostly about this place called Senegal. So Senegal's not... there's not the same question of, say, like, plantation, large plantations. I do mention a handful of larger kind of peanut plantations in a particular area that's now what we would call Guinea. But in general, they're people were mostly smallholders, and they were trying to expand their land under cultivation with more labor. But there, I don't think we could talk about a system in which, you know, there are thousands of enslaved people working for one plantation owner. That's not so much the model in this part of the world, although it does, it did happen on a few occasions.
Right. Okay, so there wasn't a domination of French rule, or as you said, British rule, you know, where they demanded slavery to make sure that there was adequate help to cultivate and develop their agricultural product to make profit. So a little bit different than what we experienced here. And not to belabor the point, but as you said, many people today rather not talk about that. I'm gonna assume that even in their education, schooling, especially middle school, high school, even universities and colleges, there is any part of this history talked about or taught
about the enslavement? So the book actually has a few different parts. So one part of the book is actually about the French conquest of a specific kingdom called Cajour. And that's something that, yeah, most Senegalese school children do learn, and especially about the person that I talk about, whose name is Latjour, who's sort of well-known as a sort of Senegalese hero of the, you know, resistance to French colonialism. But the part about enslavement is less well-known, and there are some disputes about maybe sort of talking about it in this way. But, I mean, again, it's a little bit complicated, of course, just because there's it's a little bit slippery as an issue, I think, to address.
Yeah.
I wanted to add one little clarification to what you were saying about,
sure.
So it's not that there were, like, French and European people were imposing slavery on the people of Senegal. No, so I'm always trying to explain that slavery sort of existed in general in Africa, and the transatlantic slave trade accelerated a kind of demand for enslaved people across Africa, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after the end of that slave trade, it didn't mean that demand retracted. So that the peanut, when its cultivation starts, becomes a kind of destination for a pool of enslaved laborers. You know, a pool of people who have been taken captive in the interior and then have been turned into slaves. So it becomes like a pool, a destination for this sort of slave production. And that the French and the British, in some cases, knew that was happening. And even though they had their own rules against slavery and had abolished slavery in their own colonies, kind of turned a blind eye to this movement. Does that make sense? And I mean,
where
we kind of get the kind of question of the way that the Europeans kind of had almost partnership in a way.
Yeah.
Where they had a kind of they can turn a blind eye here, but spouted a kind of rhetoric about freedom, about liberty elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of like the heart of what I'm trying to get at in the book.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part of it, Jory, is the fact that there's, you know, when we use the label slavery, everybody thinks, oh, yeah, that's where you dominate a certain class of people or certain people, and you put them in forced labor. It may be in this general sense that's true, but as you said, ideologies and cultural differences defined how slavery was here in this country versus other parts of the world. And that's what I found very interesting in your book, that, you know, it wasn't homogeneous. It was not the same everywhere. The way people looked at slavery, the way people approached slavery. Which leads me to the next question, and I touched upon it earlier when we talked about slavery in this country. Did people who worked in the cultivation of the peanuts actually did the day-to-day backbreaking work. Was there any resentment, or were they compensated in some fair way? I mean, as you said, in many ways it was cooperative, because at the end of the day, it was profitable. So was there a sort of understanding that, hey, you know, I'm not the boss, but, you know, I'm living okay. My family's being provided for, so I'm not going to rock the boat.
Of the enslaved people, do you mean?
Yes.
Well, you know, so there are a few things. The book explores a kind of particularity about about peanut farming in that time, and the kind of shifts that are happening both in the economy and sort of governance of this region as the colonial government starts to take control over more and more land. Paradoxically, even though the peanut cultivation had been a destination for enslaved people, but as people were able to take their freedom, they were able also to grow peanuts and you know, go on and live their own lives. So it's kind of like a little bit of a brain teaser.
Yeah.
Because like once you, it's just because peanuts were profitable, and so that people could get money. So even if you were an enslaved person in this system, typically you did have the right to some amount of profit from your work, right? So that most of the peanut profit probably went to the owner. But some might have gone to, you might have been able to get a little bit. And so since they're getting, like, hard currency, they're able to save up and, like, buy their freedom. On another different kind of example, because the book explores this work of a mission for a shelter for runaway slaves, so people who run away and gotten their freedom through some other means, through the means of the statute for freedom in the colonial capital. Maybe later they decide they want to go set themselves up somewhere. It's hard to get land. Maybe you might be at risk. But if you go to certain places and you're growing peanuts, you might have the ability to support yourself. So there are all these with small little contradictions.
Yeah. That system almost sounds like, for lack of a better term, a little bit of a profit sharing there. Yeah, you didn't get the bulk of it, but you had something to at least sustain. At least it sounds like many of the people did. But nonetheless, what I find, again, what's so fascinating about the book, and I don't think most people even realize that, you know, slavery here versus slavery someplace else, there were variations, whether it was the harsh treatment, whether there was fair compensation one way or the other. And then, you know, we've only got a few moments left, but another critical part of your book is the fact that, as you said, those who were not happy, those who felt this is not how I want to live my life, they were able to, through the efforts of an African-born missionary who helped to both harbor some of these individuals and help them escape. Is that right?
Yeah, well, yes. Some of them have. He helped them, yes, in some cases, escape. So many people, when they fled, came to the colonial capital, San Luis, which was not supposed to have any, you know, I think the statute says something like, you know, that the French soil should free all those who step upon it, right? So, but that statute was itself it was a little misleading. It would take some months for you to get your freedom. And so then in some cases, this man, Walter Taylor, who was a Sierra Leonean missionary, would on occasion like harbor some people and hide them in his house or in others to so that they could wait out that amount of time until they could claim their freedom.
Yeah, you have to give the guy credit. I mean, he had he had the compassion in one sense for these people, and secondly, I'm sure there was some risk involved in his own his own safety and how people may react to the fact that he was doing that. But I'm sure for those who found solace and found comfort through his actions, we're very, very grateful. In the few moments that we have, was this a book that has affected you personally in any way?
Affected me personally. I don't know if it affected me personally more than the years of research that I spent in dusty archives, probably developing allergies.
Not to mention long nights writing, but I mean, I guess I'm talking about emotionally. Again, learning that slavery existed in other parts of the world. This is how it played out. In this region of the western part of western part of Africa versus here. So I didn't know if it had a different type of impact than if you were to pick up a book about U.S. slavery, as I said, during the Civil War, if there was anything different that, stood out for you.
Well, I would say that, I embarked on this this research journey, which did take many, many years, with a kind of question in my mind about, because I did already know that slavery existed in Africa, mm-hmm. right? But I didn't know how people continued to deal with it today. Certain people, not all people. And I think that I had a kind of imaginary project in my mind about what that meant, this kind of, roll of the dice of enslavement, what it meant to be enslaved and be sent across the ocean, or be enslaved and be sent across the savannah. What was that difference? And I guess there was a kind of search in a way for kind of kinship, not exactly, but a kind of shared experience. I think that's how I in some way saw it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great way of describing it, a shared interest, because it was indeed, the label is slavery, how it was delivered, how it was meted out, and how people reacted to it, certainly from one continent to another, and that's what you clearly were able to bring to light in this book. Slaves for Peanuts is a great read. It's a little different than if you were reading, as I said at the outset, Jory's book is different than if you were reading about American slavery here, especially during and prior to the Civil War. So it does bring it to another dimension and define it in an entirely different way. Jory, if people wanted to get more information about your work, your research, et cetera, in addition to reading the book, is there a website or a way that they can reach out to you?
Sure. My website's just www.jorylewis.com, and then I'm just at Jory Lewis on all the social media, on Twitter, on Instagram.
And that Jory is, I just want to let people know, Jory is spelled J-O-R-I. As Jory said, she's put it out there. The invite is out there. So questions, research on this work that she has been passionately involved in is certainly part and parcel. And you can find that, as she said, on the site there. The book is Slaves for Peanuts. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, author and journalist Jory Lewis. A great read and another dimension in the realm of slavery. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I always welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, @WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.